I will exalt you, Lord, for you lifted me out of the depths and did not let my enemies gloat over me. Lord my God, I called to you for help, and you healed me. You, Lord, brought me up from the realm of the dead. You spared me from going down to the pit. Sing the praises of the Lord, you, his faithful people. Praise his holy name. For his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may stay for the night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. When I felt secure, I said, I will never be shaken. Lord, when you favored me, you made my royal mountain stand firm. But when you hid your face, I was dismayed. To you, Lord, I called. To the Lord, I cried for mercy. What is gained if I am silenced, if I go down to the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it proclaim your faithfulness? Hear, Lord, and be merciful to me. Lord, be my help. You turned my wailing into dancing. You removed my sackcloth and clothed me with joy, that my heart may sing your praises and not be silent. Lord my God, I will praise you forever.
Hey, good morning. It's good to see you. Thank you for that time of worship. And let me just say welcome to those who are in our overflow room and also on Facebook Live. Thank you for joining us in worship today. So in 1981, a Jewish rabbi by the name of Harold Kushner wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This particular book was born out of his own experience of losing his 14-year-old son to a rare genetic disease. The book covers basically their experience of discovering this disease and then all the doctor's visits and then ultimately losing his son. He wrote the book basically as a way to comfort those who are experiencing a loss of their own, those who are experiencing their own bad thing. The book is essentially just that. It's a guide to finding comfort during those times. But as well, Rabbi Kushner addresses the question of why. Why is it that bad things happen to good people? Why is it that God allows these things to happen? This was a struggle that Kushner had in his own life as he experienced what was going on. And as a Jewish scholar, as a Jewish rabbi, he wanted to answer this question. Why is it that bad things happen? It's a question that all of us have. Really, it's not just why do bad things happen to good people. The question that all of us have is, why do bad things happen to me? You know, bad things may happen to a good person on the other side of the world, but that doesn't really keep me up at night. It might sadden me for a moment, but that's not ultimately what I want to know. What I want to know is, why do bad things happen to me, or why do they happen to people that I love, which, since I'm hurting for them, again, the question comes back to, why do bad things happen to me? That was the struggle that Kushner had in his book, and as a Jewish scholar, this was something that he wrestled with, and it's basically a dilemma that has been around for Jews and for Christians for centuries and centuries. And the dilemma goes like this. If God is all good, then he doesn't want bad things to happen. If God is all powerful, then he can stop bad things from happening. So if God is all good and all powerful, then the question is, why do bad things happen? So Kushner, in his book, wrestles with this and ultimately comes to the conclusion that yes, God is all good and doesn't want bad things to happen, but God is not all powerful. In his book, he basically says there are some things that are outside of God's control, that God does the best that he can, but some things are just too far for him to control. And that's why bad things happen to good people. Now, as you can imagine, both Jewish and Christian scholars have criticized his book for that particular conclusion, that they would say that God is all good and all powerful in spite of bad things happening. Put me in that camp. I agree with that. I think God, in spite of bad things, is still all good and all powerful. But the question still remains. Why is it that bad things happen? Why is there suffering? Why do bad things happen to us? That is a topic that is impossible to cover in one sermon, even one book. But we are this morning going to look at one reason why sometimes bad things happen. Now, we're continuing our series in the book of Psalms today. And we're looking at Psalm 30, another psalm of David. David was the second king over Israel. David was the writer of nearly half of the Psalms. And David in this psalm reflects upon his own bad thing. He reflects upon a time of suffering. And while we do not know the exact details of this suffering, he does give us the reason why. He tells us why this bad thing happened to him. That ultimately, for David, as he looked back on it, he realized that this experience was God's discipline in his life. That the reason this bad thing happened to David was God was trying to wake David up, to get his attention, and to get David to refocus his life on him. I think all of us can talk about that experience happening in our own lives, where God does something, brings some event, some bad thing, and suddenly we are awakened from our spiritual stupor and we suddenly turn back to God, and suddenly prayer and the Bible and church and worship all become very important to us because this bad thing has happened. As we walk through this psalm this morning, we'll see exactly how God uses this kind of discipline in our lives and several things about it. So the first thing that we see is that when God disciplines us, God disciplines me, number one, it is temporary. It is not something that lasts forever. Here's what we read in verse 1. I will exalt you, Lord, for you lifted me out of the depths and did not let my enemies gloat over me. Lord my God, I called to you for help and you healed me. You, Lord, brought me up from the realm of the dead. You spared me from going down to the pit. Sing the praises of the Lord, you his faithful people, praise his holy name. For his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may stay for the night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. Again, we do not know the exact details of what had happened to David. It's impossible to pinpoint the exact event in his life that he is describing here. But what we know is that it was rough. David describes this experience as being among the realm of the dead. Like he was physically close or emotionally close to death. He describes this experience as being in a pit. That he felt that he was just at the bottom of life. That it was that rough, it was that tough. Whatever the bad thing that had happened to David was, it was extremely rough. But David said it wasn't forever. He said as bad as it was, God did not simply leave him in that pit forever. In fact, what he says was that weeping stayed for the night, but rejoicing came in the morning. I mean, David here paints this beautiful picture of being at his house and a guest knocks on the door, and the guest, when he opens the door, that guest is weeping, and weeping walks in and stays for the night. And all night long, weeping is there, but the next day as the sun begins to rise over the city, weeping leaves the house and another guest named Joy comes in. And with the new day brings this new guest who then camps out there for the day. This guest is named Joy. David says, yes, I may have soaked my bed with tears during the night, but the new day brought a new hope and it brought a new joy. God's discipline comes and it's tough and it's harsh, but it's not forever. At the top of your Bible, if you've got a Bible, whether it's digital or paper, at the top it may say that this psalm was used in the dedication of the temple. That would have come after David. It was built and dedicated after David had died. Some Bibles will say that it was used at the dedication of the palace. That was the palace where David lived. So this may have been used, and David may have written it for the dedication of the palace. We're not sure. It may have been written by David and used later at the dedication of the temple. We don't really know. What we do know is that David had written this particular psalm that later became part of the worship of the Jewish people. They would sing this song in worship to remind themselves that God is faithful even in the harshest of times. When we're going through a rough season, when we're in the pit, when we're close to the realm of the dead, David said, sing this song to remember that God is faithful to not leave you there forever. So the first thing that we know is that it's temporary. The second thing we know about God's discipline is that it is effective. When God disciplines, it is very effective. Look at verse 6. David wrote, when I felt secure, I said, I will never be shaken. Lord, when you favored me, you made my royal mountain stand firm. But when you hid your face, I was dismayed. So again, the exact circumstances are not clear. We do not know what David was going through, but we do know from this verse here that it was the condition of David's heart. We know what led to this discipline by God. He said, when I felt secure, I said to myself, I will never be shaken. Essentially, David had gotten to the point in his life where he felt like, I've got it made. No one can touch me. I've got enough money that I can protect myself with money. I've got troops around me. I live in this castle with this fortress. No one can touch me. David had gotten very cocky. And he said, I will never be shaken. I'm good. In fact, implied here, David was saying, I'm so good, I don't really need God. I've got it made. I'm okay. I don't really need God. Then he goes on and says, to you, Lord, I called. To the Lord, I cried for mercy. What is gained if I am silenced? If I go down to the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it proclaim your faithfulness? So here's what David did. Got to this point that he was cocky. Man, I got it made, and I don't need God, and I'm fine on my own. And then this bad thing happens. Whatever that bad thing was, it hit his life, and he realized in his own strength, with his money, with his own power, he could not get himself up out of this pit. So what does he do? Turns to God, right? You know, at the bottom, you can't fix the situation. What do? You turn to God. He turns to God, and he prays to God, and he decides he's going to play let's make a deal with God. God, I'm going to strike a bargain with you. Here's the bargain, God. You get me up out of this pit. You get me out of the realm of the dead. God, here's my promise to you. I will praise you. God, I will glorify you. I will lead others to praise your name. And here, God, just in case you don't know this, I know you're God, but just in case you don't understand this, God, if I'm dead, I can't do that. If I'm in the dust, I can't praise you. So God, here's the bargain I'll strike with you. Rescue me, get me out of this situation, and I'll praise your name. I'll tell everyone what you have done for me. I will lead others to glorify you. God, if you will just save me from this situation. Now, I think all of us have been there, right? We get to the bottom, we're in the pit, it is awful. And man, that's when we really start talking to God. If you're not a professional in the church world, you may not know this, but those of us who work in churches, those who are in ministries, who read blogs, who read books, who read emails about this, we know about this fact. It is all over. Everyone who has studied this and they've done all this research, they have talked about the fact that in our nation, Christianity is on the decline big time. I mean, those who follow Christ are dwindling in number. Churches are closing their doors every week. This is just a known fact among those of us who work in this business. And it's just what it is. There are far fewer people in younger generations who are coming to accept Christ than in the generations that are dying off. It's just a reality of our country. Interesting thing is, around the world, in other countries, Christianity is exploding. But in our nation, it's on a major decline. And there have been all these studies, why is this happening and what's going on? I think one of the major reasons is that we are the wealthiest nation on the planet. And because we are so financially secure, and because we are the most powerful nation on the planet, and we are secure physically, I think we've forgotten about God. I think that we say, you know, do I really need God? I mean, think about it for just a moment. Every one of you in here will leave today, and I could pretty much bet everyone not virtually everyone, everyone will get into an automobile with air conditioning, and you will leave from this church, and you will go either to a restaurant or to your house, and you will have food waiting on you. I mean, you might have to prepare it, but it's in the refrigerator, it's in the pantry, or you'll go to a restaurant and someone has prepared it for you. And you will get to eat today and not really worry about your next meal. In fact, my guess is every one of us in here will eat lunch today unless you're on some crazy diet and you're intentionally not eating, but that is your choice. You're not having to not eat, right? You're going to get to eat. And you'll go home into your house that has a roof that doesn't leak and it's air conditioned. And then you will go and you will get into a comfortable bed and take a nap. Or maybe you'll pick up a remote and you'll point it at this screen and just, wow, television comes on. And either through cable or through some streaming service, you will have access to thousands and thousands of different shows to entertain you as long as you want. And as you lay there watching those shows, you likely do not worry that an army from a neighboring country is suddenly going to invade and attack and that you're going to be at risk. Now, I know there some of you, you're gun freaks and you've prepared for it, but the chances of it actually happening, very slim, right? I mean, we live in the wealthiest, the most secure nation in the world. And so it doesn't surprise me at all when I talk to people about God and the Bible and salvation, they look at me and go, saved? What do I need to be saved from? I mean, my life is great. Why do I need salvation? Salvation doesn't seem all that necessary, right? Until something pierces through that veil of false security and wakes us up and gets our attention. This bad thing comes that we in our own power with our money cannot fix on our own, right? When that happens, suddenly our spiritual antennas go up and we're praying like we've never prayed before. And we become really interested in church. And we become really interested in what the Bible has to say. And we become very interested in salvation. And we become especially interested in God answering prayer, right? I've seen this all the time in my ministry. You know, a guy who is successful in business and he's well off financially. And so he is cruising along and yeah, he goes to church on the high holidays, you know, Easter and Christmas and a few other times. But that's really kind of it, you know, because hey, he's doing well and who really has time for God and everything's going great. And I just don't need to get too serious about any of that. And then suddenly one day he loses one of his major clients. His income drops in half. He's got to pay these bills. He's got to pay his employees. But now what does he do? His money is gone. What happens to that guy? I've seen it so many times. Man, I want to know what God has to say to me right now. Suddenly, I'm very interested in church and the Bible and what God wants to do in my life. For years, I was in student ministry, and I would see this thing happen in the lives of teenagers. You know, they're going along, their family goes to church, they were on the roll, their name would be there, but I would hardly ever see them. They're involved in sports, they're involved in school stuff, they're cruising along and life is great. And let's face it, you're 16 years old, you're healthy, you feel great, you wake up every morning, your back doesn't hurt, you're not going to the doctor all the time, life is good, right? And you've got friends and you're involved in sports and you're doing, you know, a decent job in school and everything is going great. And then that bad thing comes. And I would see a teenager, something would happen. They would get injured. They suddenly couldn't play baseball anymore. Suddenly couldn't play football. Some bad event would take place and boom, they're interested in God. Man, I want to know. They're coming to church. We would have a youth retreat. They were the first to sign up. This bad thing got their attention. And they wanted to know what God had to say to them. Or the couple who are empty nesters, You know, and the kids are finally out of the house. We're free, free at last. And, you know, we can retire and we can travel and we're gone all the time. And, yeah, church, we've got our church. We're not really interested in church because we're doing all these other things. And, you know, we were just really right now, we're not going to a Bible study. We're not really, you know, we do the little prayer maybe before a meal. But that's kind of it because we're just going along. And then one of them goes for their annual physical and the doctor says, I don't like the look of this. I don't like, we're going to send you for more tests. This doesn't seem good at all. And suddenly this couple who had zero interest in spiritual things, they're praying like they never prayed before. Because God used this bad thing to get their attention. There's a famous quote by C.S. Lewis from his book, The Problem of Pain, that goes like this. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. As much as we don't like it, I think all of us would admit that this is true. If I sat down with you and I started talking about our spiritual journey and all the different times in life where we have really been close to God, I just bet that if I asked you, when did you read your Bible the most? When were you going to church the most? When were you praying the most? You would say it was when this bad thing happened. Financially, we were at the end. We didn't know what to do. We just prayed and prayed. Had this relationship and it went south and I thought he was the one, I thought she was the one, and man, that thing, it just exploded, and man, I was talking to God like I had never talked to God before. You know, I had this physical thing that happened, this health thing that happened, and you know, I was just kind of coasting, and then that thing hit my life, and man, I was praying. Whenever God brings one of these bad things into our lives, it's effective. It gets our attention. So the third thing we know is when God disciplines me, it is for my good. Look at how David wraps up this psalm. He wrote, "Hear, Lord, and be merciful to me. Lord, be my help. You turn my wailing into dancing. You remove my sackcloth and clothe me with joy, that my heart may sing your praises and not be silent. Lord, my God, I will praise you forever." So here David reflects back and he kind of goes back to the whole theme of the psalm. You turn my wailing into dancing. There was weeping for the night. There's joy in the morning. And then again, he uses this beautiful picture of a sackcloth. A sackcloth was this awful clothing made out of goat's hair. It was coarse and it was scratchy. And if somebody wore it, it was a symbol of mourning. And it was also a reminder to that person of their situation. Every moment of the day, you're wearing the sackcloth and it's scratching and you can't sleep, you can't get comfortable. And it was a reminder of the bad thing that was happening in that person's life. And so David here says, God, you did this incredible thing. You removed that sackcloth, this awful garment, and you put on me a brand new garment called joy. You took off that which was uncomfortable and awful, and you redeemed my situation. You put on this new clothing, this new outfit that's called joy. You turned my life around, and you did it, God, that my heart may sing your praises and not be silent. God, you brought this bad thing into my life to get my attention, to change my focus, to change my attitude, and you did it, God, that I would no longer be silent and that I might praise you forever. And David looks back on this experience and says, God, what you did for my good. There is a passage in the New Testament book of Hebrews, chapter 12, that's really a parallel to Psalm 30 that talks about God's discipline in our lives and specifically how it is for our good. If you've got a Bible and you want to turn there, it's Hebrews 30. And in verse 7, he says this, "Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, true sons and daughters at all." So here's what he says to begin with And he says, hey, if God's not disciplining you, you're not really a follower of Christ. You're not legitimate. If you've ever wondered why evil people get so much success in life, you know, why they get the wealth and they're posting pictures from their yacht in the Virgin Islands on Instagram and they have their own reality show and all of that, and you're like, God, you know, why do they get all of that? Well, God is not disciplining them. They're not legitimate sons or daughters of God. God says, if you're truly a follower of Christ, God as a loving father will correct you. God as a loving father will bring discipline into your life. Think about it this way. Let's say that you and I are in a restaurant together, and I'm at one table, and I've got my family, and my kids are there, and you're at another table, and you've got your family and your kids are there, and I look over and your kids are running around the table and they're standing on their chair and they're yelling and screaming, they're making all kinds of noise. I might be really annoyed, but I'm not going to walk over and discipline your kids. They're not my responsibility, right? So I'm not going to discipline them. Why? Because, you know, if they grow up and they're crazy adults, they're nuts, that's your issue, not mine. You know, I don't love your kids the way that I love my kids. Well, let's say, same scenario, we're in the restaurant, and my kids are running around. Let's say that one of my kids is standing on the chair, that one of my kids is making a lot of noise. What am I going to do? I'm going to discipline, right? We're going to go outside to the car. We're going to have prayer meeting in that car. You know, I'm going to bring a bad thing into the life of my child. Why? Because I love my child. And I don't want them to grow up to become an adult that runs around a restaurant and acts crazy. I don't want them to end up on Jerry Springer talking about how I never disciplined them and, you know, how awful I was as a parent. I'm going to discipline them. Why? Because I love them. They're my children. God does the same thing to us. When we get out of line, God as a loving father disciplines us. Here's the next thing that he says. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? They disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. Here's essentially what he said. All of us have had parents who disciplined us, and they did the best that they could. They did the best that they knew how, but at the end of the day, they were not perfect. They were flawed human beings who disciplined us, and yet, if we're wise, we look back on their discipline, and even though it did not seem fun at the time, we are thankful that they did that. We're thankful that, yes, you taught me right from wrong. He says, they were imperfect, and we're thankful for what they did. God is perfect. God is all-knowing. God, every bit of discipline that comes into our life, God has set for our good. And if we're thankful for what our parents did, we should be even more thankful for God disciplining us because he is the one who does it perfectly, right? And then he concludes with this. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So here's what he says. When you go through it, it's okay to say this stinks. No discipline seems fun at the time. No child says, man, that spanking was great. You know, let me figure out how I can get another spanking. You know, no teenager who's had their phone taken away because they did something wrong says, well, man, I hope I don't ever get that thing back. You know, hey, what can I do to have my phone taken away forever? No one does that, right? You know, no one likes discipline. But later we look back and we go, oh, I needed that. I mean, I was out of line. I was missing it. I needed that in my life. That's what David does in this psalm. David looks back on whatever that bad thing was, and he says, as awful as it was, in the pit, at the point of death, as awful as it was, I see how God did that in my life to refocus me on him and to change my perspective and to change my attitude and to get me back where I needed to be. A couple of weeks ago, on the anniversary of 9/11, our two oldest children were at dinner one night, and they began to ask us questions about that day. And they had obviously talked about it in school, and so they began to say, well, you know, what do you remember, and where were you? And so I got to tell them the story of where I was that Tuesday morning. I was serving a church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I can remember we were in a staff meeting early that morning, and there was a guy sitting next to me who kept getting a call from his wife. And so he left the meeting, and he came back in, and he said, hey, something's happened in New York. A plane has hit a building. And so the meeting broke up, and we went, and we found a television, and by the time we turned it on, the second tower had been hit. And we stood there and watched as flames were shooting out of the windows of both of those towers, and all the reporters were trying to guess, well, why did this happen? You know, who was behind this? And at this point, all they really knew is that it was not an accident. You know, it just wasn't coincidence that two planes had hit buildings. They knew that it was some kind of attack, but, you know, really beyond that, it was just guesswork. And then I remember watching as one tower fell, and then 30 minutes later, the second tower fell, and all the rescue people rushing around, and all the lives that were lost, and all that was going on that day. And I can remember just the incredible tragic feeling that our country had. In fact, if you're about 30 or over, you remember exactly where you were that day. You remember where you were when you heard the news about that attack. And you remember the rest of that week how we as a nation just shut down. You remember schools were canceled and businesses closed and the stock market shut down and they canceled sporting events, football games didn't happen, just everything shut down the rest of that week. And then again, if you're almost 30 or over, you probably were in church that following Sunday. My guess is you remember being in church that Sunday. It was September 16th, 2001, and churches all across our nation were packed that day. I was in Charlotte at the time, and I remember that our worship center there holds about 1,800. That particular day, we had, you know, no seating capacity. You know, most Sundays we'd have about 1,000 or 1,200, but that particular day, every seat was filled. And what I remember was a bunch of men had given up their seats, and they were lined along the side walls and along the back of the worship center, standing up, leaning against the wall, because everybody that day wanted to hear the answer to the question, where was God? What was God doing in the midst of this? Why did God allow this bad thing to happen? On that Sunday, September 16th, 2001, a guy named Tim Keller was pastoring a large church in New York City. And he talked about how he had to get up that day and he had to address a congregation who actually knew people who had died. They were neighbors and friends and maybe even family members with people who had been in those buildings or people who had served as rescue workers. And he talked about the weight that he felt that day as he stood up behind this pulpit to address a group of people who, with watchful eyes, wanted to know, Pastor, what does God say about this? This awful thing that has happened. What does God say? And Keller talked about it as he stood there and said, there's so many questions that are still unanswered. He says, but I can tell you this. If you're a follower of Christ, here's what you need to know. And he used this illustration about this reoccurring nightmare that he would have about his wife dying. And he would wake up in the morning and it would feel so real to him that his wife had in fact passed away. And then he would feel the kiss of his wife on his cheek and he would hear her say good morning, and that would remind him that it was all just a nightmare, that it was all just a bad dream. And then he went on to say, if you're a follower of Christ, the promise that we are given is that one day we will spend eternity with God in heaven. And all the bad things we experience in this life, whether it's God's discipline or just being part of a broken world, all of that will be a dream, will be like a nightmare. That just like the dream you had last night is now fading from your memory, in eternity, all that will fade. As we get to spend forever in the perfect arms of the one who died for us, Jesus Christ our Lord.